This is KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. Welcome. Thank you for tuning in today. Please join us on Twitter at KUOW. We're asking an important question today. What is going on with kids and screens?
Finding screen addiction is taking a toll on children.
What are all those touch screens doing to all those growing little brains?
Pull out your smartphone or maybe your tablet, and then your kids just throw a fit until you can hand it over to them.
A new poll revealing nearly half of all moms and dads think their kids spend too much time in front of screens. Agreed.
Yes, cable news agrees. We are doing it wrong. But for one thing, is our screen panic exaggerated? And where there is a problem, how can we do better? I have two guests today. NPR's lead education blogger, Anya Kamenetz, has written a book called The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. Welcome, Anya.
Thanks, Bill.
And Seattle physician and filmmaker Delaney Rustin. She did the documentary Screenagers. Welcome back, Delaney.
Great to be here.
Let's begin with a question from a young screen user. Luella has a question.
I know that you should only be on the computer for about 2 hours a day. And people always say, don't be on any more than that because it's bad for you. And I don't know why it's bad for you.
That's a great question. Some grown-up told Luella that it's vaguely bad for you, and she doesn't understand why. I suppose you could ask, she doesn't have to understand, she's a kid, get off the screen. But I think kid curiosity, we generally think, is a good thing. So, Anya, what's the problem?
Well, so for my book, I delved into the research. And, of course, most of the research we have on kids and screens is about television, because that's where all the decades of history lie. But the risks that Luella might be worried about include interfering with your sleep, if you look at screens, especially with the blue light close to your face after dark. More than 2 hours a day doubles the risk of obesity in children. And there's a host of behavior issues that can arise or somehow be correlated or connected to an excess use of screen media. And those really range the gamut from attention issues to behavior issues and school issues as well.
Delaney, I've just told my kids that it turns your brain to mush. I haven't actually researched that. I haven't been to the Allen Institute for Brain Mushiness in South Lake Union. Is there anything to do we actually know that that's true? Did I just lie to my kids?
I think you're doing yourself a disservice, Bill, because all these headlines of the scare tactic, it's really a problem because we are going to not get buy-in from kids because they're not experiencing the intensity that we think in the headlines, cyberbullying and intense predators, et cetera. So I think that—
Hopefully not, and usually not.
And usually not. They're not experiencing that. So why should they then believe us when they actually enjoy it so much when we— you know, scare them. Much more effective to say, it is fantastic. It's so fun. You can figure out what you want to do. But it's a marker for displacing a lot of other opportunities of things we should be also spending time on.
Agreed, Anya? Talk to them about, get in their world about how fantastic screens are before the next step?
I mean, just from a psychological point of view, it makes a lot of sense to build consensus with your kids, especially when they're school age, instead of just setting strict limits. What I advocate is actually a step further in the art of screen time, which is, joint engagement is what the American Academy of Pediatrics talks about, which is enter into screen time with your kids and discover things together. There are interests that you both have, ways of getting creative, using media, screens on the side.
Will you tell me a story? Give me an example of what joint engagement looks like to you.
Yeah, I know that's an arcane term. So, for example, my daughter really loved the movie Mulan. A lot of kids do this, princess. She's a Chinese princess warrior. Turns out there's an actual poem that it's based on that we looked up together. We got her the outfit on sale at a thrift store, and we acted out the show all the time. She really liked the bathtub scene, so we'd get through bath time with that. And we even got a set of Chinese flashcards that she was excited about because this is the language of Mulan. So playing and also learning, taking advantage of that interest.
It's interesting because, as you know, youth are spending so many hours on video games. And when I ask an audience with screenagers, how many of you fathers are playing with your son's video games? So few hands go up.
Well, doesn't the diving into the fantasticness of Mulan and video games, what does that do to limit screen time? It sounds fun.
Absolutely. But unless we come to this and with the reality that there's so many wonderful things about it, kids are going to just become defensive and not engage in the conversation. And this is what this is all about, is raising mindful kids so that they become adults that have balance.
And I think, you know, the other reason it makes sense to do this joint engagement is you take something that's in the screen and you extend it out into the 3D world. Mm. And so we might have only watched the movie. We only watched screens on Saturdays. That's our rule at our house. And so she could only see the movie once a week when she was really into it. And that playtime kind of extended through the week and helped her, you know, stay connected to that story.
That's interesting. So it's not like she's been cut off from Mulan. She's living Mulan if that's her thing, but in the real world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe I should get your sort of your I want to know, what are other people doing? What's going on in other houses? So, Delaney, your kids are older. They're teenagers now. But, you know, best as you can, give us a picture. What are we talking about? What's your is or was your screen approach?
Well, let me tell you, when I started making screenagers almost 6 years ago, when I started into it, I was completely didn't know at all what rules to have. And in fact, the film is my journey to figure that out. But what was so interesting is how self-conscious I was to say some of my rules in the film. For example, one of them is I decided to not allow us to use our phones in the car. And I said, oh boy, you know, helicopter mom, overprotective. And that's what I saw repeatedly, that parents are worried to say their rules because they're worried about being judged. But ultimately, our three...
Too helicopter or too much the opposite?
Exactly. And so basically, for our family, it's basically around sleep, study time, and family time. Sleep, 100% devices out of the bedroom, and I collect them now. My daughter is 16. At 9, she hands it over.
What about a meditation app at bedtime?
I like to put those...
That calms them down.
I tell people to put it in the other room, and they can use a Bluetooth to get to the kid if they use some sort of music or something, but to not actually have the device
that's
right
not
next
cheating.
To them. Not cheating okay. at all. No, that's one of the positives of tech, that we have all these mindfulness things.
Right.
For study time, about having the cell phone a different part of the room, ideally out of the room, and doing tech breaks. I do a weekly blog, and I gave a bunch of homework tactics because that's really challenging for families. And then finally, around family time, not at mealtime. When we go out together, we try to limit it. Like I said, the car. And you know, really just having a few basic ones and then being consistent is key.
Anya Kamenetz, NPR's lead education blogger, again, the author of The Art of Screen Time. And by the way, she's at the Finney Neighborhood Center tonight at 7:30. How about you, Anya? What's going on in your home, your car, your minivan, whatever it is?
Well, we live in Brooklyn, so we don't have a car.
Okay.
And there's no cell phone reception in the subway yet.
Mm.
So we have a...
And you're lobbying to keep that the case?
Well, it's nice to have one place where you don't have to check it. But so I have a 6-year-old and a 15-month-old. The 6-year-old, like I said, it's screen time on Saturdays. So that's our day for movies, cartoons, whatever she wants, provided that she balances it with other stuff. During the week, we have 3 iPad sessions a week that she can have, and it's sort of a pass system that she can decide if I use it today, I may not be able to use it later in the week. And that's her decision. My husband's much better than I am on sharing that time with her. And sort of, you know, he gets into the latest app and the latest game, and he wants to play alongside with her. Sometimes he'll even be playing it on his own, and I have to get him to get her in there. And then with the toddler, the struggle is keeping my phone out of sight when she's around. And she reinforces that because she'll grab it out of my hands if I take it out to check my email or take a photo.
But what's the big deal of that you're using it in her sight? So what? You're the grown-up. You do mysterious things.
Well, that's,
she can't do.
That's exactly the issue, actually. You know, for parents, the phone really is this black mirror. And I think a lot of parents have to practice better on their own setting limits and balance, because kids are going to learn from us, and they also can suffer when parents are very distracted by their phones. You know, this interrupts that, having the machine in your hand, in your view, it interrupts your conversation and interrupts the language development and the attachment that can go on. So I'm a little bit, you know, what do you think about that, Delaney?
Anya, one thing that I've found really helpful talking to families now is it's just too aloof to say model in general. Because as a physician, when I say to patients, you know, eat better, it's really not defining. So what I found effective is to have parents pick one goal that they're trying to achieve and to share that goal with their kids. And for example, for me, on Tuesdays after dinner, I try to not go on screens. Mm. And I ask my teenagers to keep me accountable, because it's amazing even saying that, I sometimes just find myself. And now we're working on this together. Now it becomes, how do you create a family where people identify goals and then the reality of how hard it is to have the goals, but it actually works out, can be really good because I have that time. They know they can have me all to themselves.
I want to chime in on that idea that we tell our kids what kind of family we are. We're into that in lots of ways. I find it very effective that the kids, they take it in. It's like, oh, we're a family that tries things, for example, you know, unfamiliar things. So I just want to say, yeah, I find that good to rally them around a group kind of identity. Here's what we do. Here's what we're trying to do. And they're into trying to help. Here's a question from Gus.
Mom and Dad say I can have 2 hours of screen time because the doctor said it does something to my eyes. What do screens do to your cornea?
So there again, Mom and Dad are giving him Gus some idea that it's not good for you. But Gus is a young budding scientist and wants to know, what does screens do to your cornea?
Well, turns out we actually don't have good data about screens and vision. A lot of ophthalmologists are feeling like they're seeing more myopia, so more problems with seeing up close. But the really good data comes from the fact that vision is affected by not getting outside enough. There we have some concrete evidence, but it makes sense that actually with all of this near vision that we are straining the eyes, and it's not going to be surprising if we do see an increase in myopia. That's not really even the cornea, but you get the idea.
I work with a guy who denies the screens all week, but by the weekend, his kids are thirsting for the screen time, and it leads to all kinds of bad confrontations. Are there any warnings we should give about, I don't know, over-limiting?
Well, that's a really interesting question. I mean, I surveyed about 500 families for the book, and I did find that, you know, there's fights on both sides. You know, whether people see themselves as being strict or permissive, it can lead to conflict. And I think, you know, if the kids are very, very attached to the screen time, there might be a way to work out a system where they feel that it's more fair, or at least they understand the reasons behind it. You know, and trying to dictate things one way, obviously our kids are always watching us, and if we're not following what we're saying, that might lead to more conflict as well.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, the fact is parents are struggling. They are so eager for solutions, and schools are too. And that's, you know, in part why I've created this. It's been 2 years now, weekly. It's called Tech Talk Tuesday, but the point of it is topics to have with your kids weekly so that it's a calm conversation. But also now we realize that in schools aren't doing their part. And I did a survey of 1,200 parents of middle schoolers and was not surprised but disheartened to learn that 55% of middle schools now are allowing kids to carry their cell phones all day. So schools aren't wanting to do the discipline that it takes to do their part to put it away for a while. So we're launching in this month, actually, a Way for the Day campaign to empower parents and teachers to go to their schools and talk about the science that shows that a Way for the Day can really actually help them emotionally as well as academically. So these are the kind of things that we need more and more of.
So my kids are still pretty young, 11, 7, 7, but so I may be naive, but what happened to parents just saying no? I mean, no, you don't have a cell phone, and you're going to be upset, and then you're not because you're going to start thinking about something else. And no, you can't watch TV, and you'll be upset, and then you'll start reading or drawing or finding, if you're bored, boredom forces you to get creative. What about just say no?
I think parents who are confident setting limits, you know, tend to have pretty good outcomes a lot of the time. The issue with screens is that they are so ubiquitous. They're just like the air that we breathe. And what we find a lot is that there's such a preferred activity for so many kids that you'll see sneaking around, you'll see going to a friend's house, and anywhere they go where the rules are different. I don't know if you were like this, but I had a household where we never had the latest snacks. And when I went over to my friend's house, they had all the Little Debbie cakes and all the ice cream I could eat. I might have gone a little nuts.
I would like to go there, actually.
I still think
you have an address?
Still think about that house, the sleepovers. But, you know, so the point is, very much like sugar, how do you teach or scaffold self-regulation? You know, it's simpler to just say no all the time, but maybe you want to figure out ways of permitting it and helping kids understand what feels like a good amount and what feels like too much within the household context.
This reminds me, just this weekend I was talking with a dad and his 13-year-old son, and the dad said, you know, I'm just worried he's spending so much time on video games. And we were leaving the house, and I said, you know, well, one thing you could do is try to define a space where you aren't on screens. Like, how about in the car? And he looked at me and he said, oh, no, I could never do that. And I'm thinking, here's this wonderful opportunity you'd have time to connect with your son in the car. But again, and the really, you know, there's a lot of reasons why parents aren't setting the rules and sticking by them. They don't know whether we're not talking enough. Two is they might just overall feel guilty because they want to be on their screens all the time. Three is they might just not, and this is a really important one, might not be able to tolerate their child being uncomfortable with them. And the thing that helps me with this is that there are hundreds of studies that show that when parents have some limits and there's some flexibility, they listen to their kids, but some limits, kids consistently do better. And having grown up in Berkeley in the 60s and 70s, when there was a lot of hands-off parenting, I could tell you it was craziness, and it made us often feel like they just didn't care.
I think there's one other issue, too, in my survey that found, you know, parents have a hard time setting the line on screen time because they use it to get a break. And they start when the kids are very young, and the screens are this really convenient way to get done what they need to get done.
The babysitter.
Well, yeah. And, you know, and we all have seen, you know, the parent with the kid out at the restaurant and they're on the iPad. And one side you can say, well, they're missing out on the ability to, you know, participate in the conversation and get socialized. On the other hand, you can say, well, if I want to take my kid out in public and it's a really child unfriendly culture that we have going, everyone's going to look at the kid if they're running around or being a kid. And so I feel like I have to hypnotize them with screens, like on a flight, right? You know, you don't want to be that kid, you know, that parent and run out of iPad time on the flight because you're really, everyone's going to look at you. So, you know, we're all kind of judging each other. And I think it's really hard for parents to set limits in that environment, too.
We've got to take a quick break. And I want to invite listeners into this conversation. Again, we're talking with NPR's lead education blogger, Anya Kamenetz, has written the book, The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. And Seattle physician and filmmaker Delaney Rustin, she did the documentary Screenagers and also does Tech Tuesday talk. What was it? Tech Talk Tuesday.
Tech Talk Tuesday. That's
good, huh?
Right.
Okay, so a quick break and inviting you in. We're talking about how to set healthy boundaries with kids and screens. I want to know, listener, are you trying this? How is it going? Tell us your story. Here's our phone number, 206-543-5869. Again, 206-543-5869. We'll take a few calls. And by the way, Anya Kamenetz is at the Finney Neighborhood Center tonight at 7:30. Okay, more after a short break. This is KUOW's The Record.
My dad says to turn off the screens when it's dinner time, but I don't want to because I bring the computer over and watch TV while I'm eating.
Let me translate that. Dad says to turn off the computer when it's dinner time, but she brings the computer to the table. Yeah, that was Natalie telling it like it is. And we're back with NPR's Anya Kamenetz, who's at the Finney Neighborhood Center this evening, 7:30, and Seattle doctor and filmmaker Delaney Rustin. And we're talking kids and screens. That was the willful 4-year-old daughter of a colleague of mine. We're talking about how to set healthy boundaries with kids and screens. I want to know, are you trying this? How's it going? Tell us your story. Again, the number 206-543-5869, 206-543-5869. So here's a 4-year-old, a willful child. You want me to turn it off at dinner time? I'll bring it to the table. So I guess turning it off is not happening easily. How do you bring around a little kid on this kind of thing?
I mean, I think, you know, you have to be clear and firm with kids.
By the way, her father confesses to being a terrible mix of too tired and too scared to confront her.
Oh, scared. Interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, with younger kids, for me, when my kids were very young, you know, dealing with this was a combination of being very clear and firm, and she understood Saturdays. So Saturdays started as a boundary for us when my daughter was two, and it led to a very intense interest in the days of the week. Every day she would ask us what day of the week was. So we made a chart.
Your teacher's saying, your child is very advanced when it comes to days of the week.
Yes. So motivated. But then also, you know, helping them deal with that transition, because it's really common for kids to have an explosion when the devices are turned off because they're so tuned in, they're getting a lot of stimulation, and when they yank it away, there can be an explosive reaction. So you have to help them with that transition, and you also have to motivate them to say, you know, if you don't say no, if you don't turn it off when it's time to turn it off, you know, maybe we won't have it next mm-hmm. time.
And I love your consistency. I mean, we all are just really little animals, and the more that we just say, you know, explain and say no, that's going to extinguish their behaviors. But if we waffle, that's where they're smart and they'll just start to dig in more.
And for this dad, I might suggest setting a timer for some reason for young kids. Sometimes the timer seems more impersonal and you can't really argue with it.
Yes.
You know,
so that's... Don't blame me. Blame the timer.
Sorry, Mr. Timer says it's TV time's gone.
Let's take a phone call from Leif in Carnation. Hi, Leif.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question or your story?
Well, I'll do the story first. My son seems to have come to us with a really strong attachment to screens. He has some reactive attachments and disorders and like that. But we've been dealing with the screen attachment almost like addiction since he came, and looking for good ideas of what to do with that.
Yeah, attachment to the point of addiction.
How old is he?
Oh, good question. How old?
Now he's 10.
Mm-hmm. 10.
Yeah, I did find in my research that there are kids who are more sensitive, and there's interactions between screen time and lots of different diagnoses, including being on the autism spectrum and attention disorders, as well as kind of a vast range of other emotional behavioral issues. And you're right to treat it pretty seriously. I think that limiting dosage it can be a really good idea, and making sure that there's, it's more slow-paced media, maybe that it's across the room can be good for some kids. Figuring out what kinds of content might be more or less likely to trigger him.
Yeah, and I would also add, it's really hard work. As humans, we often only change behavior if we are desperate. You might not be desperate yet, and that's good, but you're probably going to need some help, some accountability. Don't just think this is super easy, even if it's a 10-year-old, because you're going to want to be just give in often. But I agree completely, Anya, that this is a perfect time to read your book, Anya's book, and there's other books out there to limit it, particularly for this kid. And I don't know what your rules are now. But again, Screenagers, our website, movie website, we have a lot about addiction on there and resources.
Leif, one more question. Are you considering, and what would be the downside of, you use the metaphor of addiction, or maybe it's not a metaphor, what about something between weaning and cold turkey? What stops you?
We want for the future for him to be able to have a relationship with screens, like your guests mentioned earlier. They're ubiquitous and pretty much necessary at this point. So I'm not sure the cold turkey approach really works in our modern world.
Right.
And the weaning mm-hmm. is what we've been trying to do since we figured this out.
Yeah, it's as my guests have said, that's the hard part. Leif, did you get an answer? Do you have another question, or did we satisfy you?
Well, I wonder how you might adapt the screenager or things applied for teenagers might mm-hmm. apply them to younger kids.
Well, one thing that's so key is for them to understand that it's just so great, these games, but that they can become all-consuming. And what's so powerful in screenagers is actually we visited a center for young men who had serious problems of their lives were really suffering because all they wanted to do was video games. And you see in one of the scenes that I love so much is one of the guys says, all of a sudden you see him playing incredible piano. And you didn't expect that really in the film. And then he goes, you know, I often think to myself, how much better I would be on the piano now if I hadn't spent all of those hours on the video games. And so many teenagers really resonate with that. And again, that gets back to what we've talked about earlier, that screen time is such a marker for other things that could be developed in association with the game. So I like that you're saying, you know, you want to find a balance and have him to have games, but what are the other things he can be doing? And as a doctor, I can tell you, when I say to my patients, don't eat this and that, it's not effective. Mm. But when I talk about, let's talk about the healthy things you like to eat and find some new ones, man, I get buy-in.
Leif, I want to take another phone call. Thank you for yours. We appreciate it.
Thanks.
Delaney Rustin, and also the author of the new book, The Art of Screen Time, is NPR's Anya Kamenetz. Joey is in Bellingham. Joey, what's your story and or question?
Well, I guess I was just listening, and I consider myself a good father, and I guess I'm not very aware of the whole controversy of screen time. You know, I work a lot, 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, and I guess I'm one of those people that fall into the role of using screens as a kind of, I don't like to say babysitter, but it gives me a time to be able to sit down on the couch, relax. The kids have already come home, done their homework by the time I get home from work usually. So I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm worried, am I neglecting them by not and playing with them, or you know what I mean?
That's a great question. Very relatable.
Oh, my gosh. And, you know, and everybody, every parent worries that they're not doing the best job they could be. And you know what? We're all screwing this up because it's so hard. And I would say that you have to take a holistic look at how your kids are doing. You know, if they're doing well in school, they've got friends, they're getting to bed on time, you guys have a good relationship. These are all strengths. Things are probably falling into place. If there's things you want to build on, you know, on those nights when you do have the energy, if you can think about watching a show together or having them show you something that they're interested in, just so you enter into that world a little bit and that it can be part of your relaxation time together. You know, family movie nights, Bill mentioned, was something that can be a great way to kind of share screen time and also, you know, give you a little bit of a break too.
And the challenge of family movie night now is that they also want to be on their phones texting to their friends. And so really defining, hey, this is going to be our time together. And cuddling or whatever that may be, it's a new challenge, though, how everyone wants to be double multitasking.
Joey, this is a big question, but basically, how are your kids doing? These kids that you sound like a loving, concerned dad, and you're busy and you're tired and their homework is done and they're on screens. What do you notice about them?
You know, I haven't noticed it being a problem, honestly. You know, my daughter, if she's not on the phone, she has her crayons and stuff out. She's, you know, she can sit and keep herself entertained doing lots of other things, not just on screen time. Mm-hmm. And my younger daughter, who's six, she's a little more attached. She likes to watch cartoons on there. But, you know, without it, they get along great also. Mm-hmm. So,
Joey, keep up the good stuff and good luck to you. And thanks for calling.
Cool. Thank you.
Any more? This is about our time. Any final thoughts, final reactions, advice for our listeners?
Well, just what the caller just mentioned, I think the key thing for people to know is that what kids are doing on these devices are being entertained, whether that's chit-chatting with friends or watching a show or whatnot. And we want to work as a society to ensure that kids are getting creative time offline, communication, and ability for competency. It's shocking that only 3% of time is spent on content creation. So let's work all together and figure out how these limits are. And I'm excited to be here today with Anya, who has this new book that's bringing, you know, highlighting all of this.
Anya, I want to hear more from you. I'm told we have time for just one more call, and then I'd like to hear your final thoughts. This is Natalie in Greenwood. Natalie, your question, your story?
Well, actually, it's my promise that anything that is from video games from a very young age with my child, I was faced with a lot of judgment from other parents when I wanted to really raise my child with a lot of things, nature, hands-on, drawings or anything, and even including taking him camping and having nothing in the car when he was little, but some few picture books. And that was consistently, over the years, judged.
Why? What was like the judgment? What did parents say to you?
Oh, they were like, oh, just like, well, I guess I'm perfect. You know, I'm like, oh, he doesn't need to watch anything in the car or take him to restaurants. You know, it was just like, oh, well, I guess you do something better than us.
Uh-huh. And is there a question about that that you want to ask our guests?
Well, it's not really so much a question, but it's just that it's the peer pressure is absolutely phenomenal.
Yes, that's true. Natalie in Greenwood, thanks a lot for that call. Yeah, here you do it your way, and you can't win. You know, you're bad for giving too much screen time, or I guess aren't you a saint?
I want to bring in the dimension here of parents and parent clickbait. So the whole conversation, the social media is fomenting amongst parents. And one of the reasons I wrote the Art of Screen Time was so that we could have an open, non-judgmental conversation without guilt or shaming each other, because we all feel so insecure about what we are doing. That's a clear statement of insecurity that's happening towards Natalie from these other parents. They don't like the light that it sheds on their own decisions. And, you know, and the fact is that the online conversation about parenting so often pushes us towards our polarized corners. And so we have to reflect on what we're doing online as parents and the kinds of conversations we're having, you know, on Twitter with me or on Delaney's website, where we're trying to get information and we're trying to actually share it in a way that's non-judgmental.
That's NPR's lead education blogger, Anya Kamenetz. Her book is The Art of Screen Time, How Your Family Can Balance Digital Media and Real Life. And you'll be talking about the book this evening, Finney Neighborhood Center, 7:30.
That's right.
Welcome from Brooklyn to Seattle. Enjoy the Finney Neighborhood Center. Delaney Rustin, the film is Screenagers. She's a physician and a filmmaker, and it's good to talk with you again, Delaney. Thanks for coming.
Great to be here, and the film still shows in Seattle all the time. So
Screenagers is the movie. And listeners, thanks for calling, writing. Good luck to you. We're not here to judge. We're here to give some ideas, and we support you. Go. You're doing great. Stay tuned. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in. 10 years ago, a young woman, who we'll call Marie, told the Linwood Police Department that she had been raped by a stranger in her apartment. And she gave the police details, what the man did, what he said to her, the items he used, specifics. But the police charged Marie with filing a false police report. As it turned out, the Linwood Police Department got it wrong, and it's not an isolated case. My guest is investigative reporter Ken Armstrong. He co-wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning story, and now the book called A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. Ken, welcome to KUOW.
Hi, Bill. Thanks for having me on.
Will you let us know why these Linwood detectives were so willing to believe that Marie made up a false story when, again, it was so vivid and awful and specific?
Yeah, I think fundamentally they failed to understand how trauma works. They treated minor inconsistencies in Marie's story, which are common among people who've been traumatized, as major discrepancies, as grounds to suspect her. They also attached outsized importance to one person's doubts about Marie's story, while ignoring all that physical evidence you just described that was right in front of them.
That person was the foster mom of Marie.
That's
who called police and said, I don't know. This seems fishy.
The day after Marie was raped, Marie grew up in the foster care system. She had probably at least 20 different placements in the foster care system as she was growing up. Her most recent foster mom contacted police the day after the report to say that she had concerns about Marie, saying that she had a history of bidding for attention. She didn't say that she thought she was lying. She just said she had concerns. But that call planted doubt in the lead detective's mind. And from there on out, everything in the investigation went sideways.
But you would think that professional detectives would have, you describe in your reporting how rare false reports are, how the problem is not, the big problem is not false reporting, but it's not reporting, and you would hope that the detectives were at a higher level of understanding the situation of rape and reporting than someone who professes doubt.
The lead detective in this case did not have much experience at all with sexual assault cases. Most of his history had been spent on patrol, or in drug investigations. In fact, he had only handled one or two previous cases involving rape. And that showed in the way that he handled it. And he spoke about that very candidly afterwards, you know, that that lack of experience came into play here.
And she recanted her story. I mean, that's key. But how did that happen?
Once they began to doubt her account, they no longer treated her as a victim of a crime. They treated her as a suspect. And they interrogated her rather than interviewing her. And interrogation techniques can exert a lot of pressure on people, particularly people who are especially vulnerable to begin with. And for Marie, she buckled under that pressure. For her, recanting was the easiest way out of what had become just an untenable situation. You know, for her, it was almost a relief to take the story back in the face of all this pressure and just walk out at the police station.
And to appreciate what that recanting was like, though, you had to have to read your account. I mean, what she wavered is a weak way to put it. She cried. She pounded the table. She said she was pretty positive. And they asked her to write the story, admitting she'd lied without reading her rights. They told her if she failed a lie detector test, she'd be booked into jail. And the police would recommend she would lose her subsidized apartment.
That's right. That, I think, played a large role in it. She, on two different occasions, was questioned by police and challenged by them, with them trying to get her to take the story back. And on the second occasion, they told her that if she failed a lie detector test, they would recommend that she lose her subsidized housing. She was 18 years old at the time. She had her first job. She was in a financially vulnerable position. The idea of being without a home was something that she just couldn't fathom.
Even if police thought that she was probably making this up, this story, this account, Linwood police could have dropped it. It's not like she named somebody who got questioned and suspected. Why did they charge Marie with filing a false police report?
Well, what was somewhat surprising is that the decision to charge was made exclusively by the lead detective in the case. This is no longer the case in Linwood, but at that time, he could make that decision unilaterally. He didn't need to have approval from any higher-ups, and there weren't clear standards as to what he needed to show in order to file a charge. Now they need definitive proof, is the terminology that they use, before they doubt a victim's claim. And now they need approval from higher up before they will go so far as to file a criminal charge.
And of course, this isn't just about this woman whose middle name is Marie. This is a bigger story. Ken Armstrong, why did you write that Pulitzer Prize winning account and this book?
Well, it goes to Marie's experience is unfortunately not isolated. It's not unique. You know, there are other instances around the country where women have been sexually assaulted, have reported it, and have not only been doubted, but have been charged criminally. It's happened in Wisconsin, in Pennsylvania, in New York. In other instances, they weren't charged criminally, but they were accused publicly by police of lying. A woman in California had a police lieutenant say she owed the community an apology. He called her story a hoax. He likened it to the novel Gone Girl. Well, subsequently, video surfaced showing that she had been telling the truth all along. This also, I think, is a particularly timely subject, given all that's happening right now with the Me Too movement. I think at the heart of the Me Too movement is this utter frustration with not being heard, with having accounts of harassment or assault be minimized or denied. Marie's experience captures that in about the most tragic way possible. If Marie wasn't heard, if a woman who was raped in her home by a stranger at knife point, a woman who had bruises on her wrists, who went to the hospital, who cooperated with police every step of the way, if she isn't heard, how much faith can others have who come forward?
And will you give us an idea what this did to Marie, this experience?
It was devastating. At the time this happened, as I mentioned, she was 18. She was in a good position, particularly when you consider all of the trauma that she had in her childhood. She had her first job, she had friends, she had a support system, she had an apartment. Almost all of that fell away. And for her, the years from that point until the rapist was captured in Colorado due to brilliant police work there, they were just terrible years. It's like her life was on loop. She couldn't get started.
And of course, people judged her. She's the kind of person who would make up a story of rape. Her friend posted a web page about her being a liar. Her former foster mom decided she couldn't spend the night anymore because she might wrongfully accuse the woman's husband. You paint a picture of the trauma. It's not just a matter of somebody being believed or not believed.
That's right. And as an example of that, she accepted a plea deal after she was charged criminally. And one of the conditions of the plea deal was that she had to get counseling. The counseling wasn't for being raped. The counseling was for lying about being raped. So here is someone who has just experienced the most horrific thing imaginable. She needs a special kind of counseling. Instead, she's getting something which is reinforcing this false assumption that she lied about what happened.
As you said, the reason we know Marie was telling the truth is that police in Colorado caught the rapist. How did those Colorado detectives treat victims differently?
They listened. They reserved judgment. They were respectful. And they investigated thoroughly. They let the evidence trump any assumptions. They did brilliant police work, both in terms of the mindset that they had going into the case and in terms of the investigative tools that they used. And if it wasn't for their brilliant work, Marie would have never been vindicated. We would still assume that she had in fact lied about what happened inside her apartment.
I'm talking with Ken Armstrong, former Seattle Times reporter, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter, and the book is called A False Report, A True Story of Rape in America. What changes have Linwood police made that other police and sheriff departments could make?
The Linwood police, to their credit, they have owned this mistake, and they have become determined to learn from it. They had an internal review conducted of how their investigation went wrong, and they had a peer review, an external review conducted. And they've taken a number of steps. Most fundamentally, the detectives now receive additional training on trauma and sexual assault. They have a much better understanding of how victims cannot be expected to act in one particular way. Victims act in all kinds of different ways. They're also instructed to not make credibility judgments based upon how someone reacts to being hurt. Beyond that, as I mentioned, they have new standards in place where they will not doubt a victim unless there's definitive proof that the account isn't true. They will not file charges unless it goes up the ladder and is reviewed by other people. They also are more respectful towards victims. They give them a say in how and when they're questioned, and they also make sure that a victim advocate is brought into the situation as quickly as possible. You know, one of the commanders there said that this is a case everybody in that department will remember forever, and they are determined that it not happen again.
Well, that training and those standards, that doesn't happen by magic. That takes money. It might take public pressure from citizens. So you listening might want to decide whether you want to get involved in how your local department treats cases of reports of rape. I do want to ask, if police put more faith in victims, someone in the book said cops must work as hard to prove a falsehood as they do to prove a truth. If police did that, does that mean they will also accidentally put more innocent men in prison?
No. If you are letting the evidence dictate, if the evidence is what brings you to your conclusion, that is how you find out whether a report is true or false. You are protecting everyone, both a person who might be falsely accused of a crime and people who are telling the truth about being a victim of a crime. If you investigate thoroughly, as the detectives in Colorado did, that is how you protect everyone.
How is Marie doing?
She is remarkably resilient. She is she is really strong. I talk to her fairly regularly. She's a long-haul truck driver. So every time I talk to her, it seems she's in a different state.
Not a different emotional state, a different state in the country.
That's right. She travels coast to coast, and that is a challenging job. But she set out to take a challenging job on purpose. You know, she said that one of the things that she did not want to do was to live in fear and to let this experience limit her in the way that she goes about her life. And that takes a lot of courage. But she's got a lot of courage.
The book is A False Report, and the co-author, Ken Armstrong, is speaking about the book at Elliott Bay this evening.
Right.
Do you know what time that is?
At 7 p.m.
7 o'clock tonight at Elliott Bay, so you can go see him and question him more and have a discussion about how we believe or don't believe people who report a crime. The Washington State House, have you heard that they passed a bill eliminating the statute of limitations for felony sexual assault? How do statutes of limitations affect rape victims?
Yeah, I have not been tracking that bill closely, but I can tell you that in Marie's case, statute of limitations became an issue in a civil suit that she filed afterwards. After the man who raped her was arrested in Colorado, Marie filed a civil suit against Linwood, the detectives, and a number of other people. And one of the defenses that was raised was that she waited too long to file the suit. The argument was made that under federal civil rights law, she only had 3 years to do that. So that statute of limitations, that can come into play on both the criminal front and on the civil side.
She won $150,000 from the city of Linwood?
A settlement.
A settlement.
The lawsuit was settled,
yeah.
And she received $150,000.
Yeah, plus some court costs, $500 in court costs.
That's right.
So in Washington State, just in case listeners are curious about House Bill 1155 regarding statutes of limitations, the law in Washington is that a rape victim under 18 has until their 30th birthday to press charges. Someone older than that has 10 years to start prosecution if the crime was reported within 1 year, but there's only 3 years to start prosecution if the crime was not reported in that 1 year period. And the key committee chair in the Senate has at last report said he's not going to give this bill a hearing. This is a Seattle Democrat, Jamie Peterson, said that, you know, he pointed out that old cases are hard to prove. Evidence can be lost or contaminated. Recollections fade. It's hard to convince a jury. He said the only crime that should have no statute of limitations is murder. And Senator Peterson said human beings deserve to go on with their lives. Any reaction?
It's unquestionably true that rape is a crime that can be solved years later. That's one reason rape kits are collected, right? Because that DNA evidence can be such powerful proof. And a lot of times those connections aren't made until years later. In Marie's case, her rape kit was destroyed after they no longer believed her. You know, so that was one of the things that was emblematic of how the investigation was ended in its entirety once they no longer believed her.
How long did they wait before destroying the rape kit?
They have certain protocols there, but by the time Mark O'Leary, the man who raped Marie, had been arrested in Colorado, the rape kit had already been destroyed.
Wow. I want to ask a question. Again, this is Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Ken Armstrong, former Seattle Times reporter. The original piece was published at the nonprofit investigative journalism site ProPublica. Why ProPublica?
It was published with both the Marshall Project, which is another nonprofit news organization that writes about criminal justice issues, and with ProPublica. And it's an odd backstory. I was working at the Marshall Project at the time, and another reporter, T. Miller, was working at ProPublica. We both began working on the same story separately, unbeknownst to the other. T. concentrated his reporting in Colorado. I concentrated mine in Washington. Months passed before we discovered that we were working on the story, the same story. Once we discovered that, we decided that we would team up and we would tell the story together. We would lock our two halves into one. And then we co-published on both of our websites, at the Marshall Project and at ProPublica.
Well, Ken, that reporting from two different locations as police far from one another tried to figure out who was attacking women, it's part of what makes it a very compelling read and a Pulitzer Prize winning account and now this book. Thank you for telling Marie's story and the wider story involved here.
Thanks, Bill.
Ken Armstrong is the author of A False Report, and the subtitle is A True Story of Rape in America. And again, he's going to be at Elliott Bay, 7 o'clock tonight, talking about the book. What do you want listeners to come away with?
Fundamentally, it is to understand that there is no one right way for someone to act when they've been hurt. Don't make assumptions about how trauma looks or appears.
Linwood police learned that lesson, say they learned that lesson, and Ken Armstrong is part of filling in stories just like that. Thanks for being here.
Great. Thanks, Bill.
And thank you for tuning into The Record on KUOW. That's it for today. The show is made for you by Amina Alsadi, Ajua Jim Abrempong, Jason Pagano, Bree Ripley, our social media producer, although Whipley is a cool name. I'm Bill Radke. So glad you joined us today, and I hope you'll join us again tomorrow.